Flying Blind episode. Welcome to the Be Different Podcast, your Catholic architecture podcast.
Is the music still playing?
The music's still playing. I'm gonna slide it down as we enter it. Today's an episode where we're gonna talk about money.
What's your name again?
My name is Chris Duffel.
And I'm Rafael Morales.
That's the intro. Welcome to Be Different Podcast. What's your name? we're gonna talk about what you can do for $1 million.
Less than $1 million.
Less than $1 million.
That's the cap.
The cap. Okay. So you have a project, Mr. Morales.
Yes.
For your beloved parish. And you would like to know what you can do. You want to make your place more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll just start off by saying it's not a new building.
Not a new building, because you can't build a new building for $1 million.
That's right. So what do you do for the prompt today? What I messaged yesterday, I said, what's top of mind? Mm-hmm. What's been most in your thoughts lately? And you responded fairly quickly. What can you do for $1 million to your church?
Yeah,
to make it better. So that's the topic. So $1 million is the total project budget.
Ceiling.
The mm-hmm. ceiling.
Yeah.
So total project budget. I mean, this is in some way our ability just to estimate, but that's all the money you have, right? That's not the construction cost. Mm-hmm. That is the amount of money. $100 million. That'd be nice.
That would be really nice.
$1 million is the maximum that the parish wants to spend.
Right.
So how do you go about, like, high level, how do you go about thinking about the first big buckets this goes into?
Yeah. Great question. I think, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is you have to know why you're renovating in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Because I will not disclose who this parish is or anything, but the motivation of a certain parish that will remain nameless was, you know, we really want to attract young people to come to the church.
Okay.
And when I hear that, the first thing I think of is that the right motivation? Is that why we should be renovating a church?
Mm.
Right. Now, I guess you could dig a little deeper and say that behind that motivation is a truer motivation, which is you want to bring more people to Christ. That's mm-hmm. a good motivation.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think having the right set of goals, the right motivation for why you're even undertaking a renovation is really important.
Mm-hmm.
So before you even think about where you would allocate money or what you would change first or second, why are you doing this in the first place?
Mm.
You know, what's deficient, what's lacking, and so on. So start there.
Okay.
So now let's assume that the reason you're undertaking this renovation is because, as is the case in so many places, you're in an old 1960s church. The people at that time did the best they could, but unfortunately, it's out.
It's not great.
It's not great.
Yeah.
It's dated. It's not beautiful. And on top of that,
may that actually meet your needs?
It doesn't meet your needs, and maybe even the materials are falling apart.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of work to be done.
Yeah. Various forms of deficiency.
Yeah. So then I guess let's begin by saying, you know, why does a church need to be beautiful? Why would you need to renovate a place like that? Because, again, to continue, because it's important to set the parameters of this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's say that there's nothing that is falling apart. So maybe it's not great and it looks dated, but it works.
Mm.
So you could foreseeably just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
You're still holding Mass. Mass is still happening.
Yeah.
You still have, you know, the Eucharist. Christ is still present at every Mass. People are still receiving communion. You can still hear. The sound system works. The lighting stinks, but it's fine. It works. Yeah. So why would you renovate it?
So there's no, like, mission critical reason to do it. There's a lot of things that are subpar, suboptimal. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of them are outright. Like maybe you have a bad AV system.
Right.
But there's nothing that's, like, prohibiting you from doing your day-to-day life of the faith.
Yeah. So there's no emergency that you're trying to solve.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. There's no emergency.
Right. Okay. So having said all of that, why would you do it in the first place? I mean, well, I'll ask you that question. Why would you want to renovate such a building?
Why would you want to renovate such a building? Well, to, I mean, it all comes back to love, right? Mm-hmm. If it engenders your prayer life and it brings you closer to God, it is categorically a good thing.
Yeah.
So there is no, you know, cost too high, let's say. Mm-hmm. So if there's a desire for the faithful and they yearn for something that's, you know, that is a transcendental, it's yeah. a good that's going to, you know, enliven the liturgy, let's say, mm-hmm. that you should respond to those calls. So if God places it on your heart and your parish wants to do it, yeah. then essentially if God says do it, you should do it.
Yeah.
So yeah. that's one reason. And you know, none of these are, the building's not leaking, the AC is not out. It's not one of these things where your diocese had a kind of professional assessment done on the lifespan of your building. And they say, you know what? Your building's more or less at the end of its useful life. It's not a practical thing. This right. discussion is not a,
no, it's,
a
not.
It's not a deferred right. maintenance program.
No, this is purely not a,
we want the yeah. building to look more beautiful.
Yeah.
We want to like a kind of offering to God in a way. This is a yeah. useless thing. There's right. no use for it.
Right.
It is its end. It's a thing that is a kind of
for its own sake. Yeah.
Part of worship. That's right.
So that, I think the word that you just said, offering is the, that's the optimal word to use here because, yeah. so first principles, reason you build a church or reason you even have a church. I forgot where I read this. I need to go back and find it because it's good. But we're essentially that the purpose of a church is twofold and it mirrors the liturgy. Mm. Number one.
Glorification of God.
And the- is for the worship and glorification of God, the worship of God specifically. Mm. And number two. For the sanctification of the people.
That's right.
That's why you build a church.
Yeah.
So how well is your current church building doing those two things? Mm.
So you're saying, what you're saying then is that that's the purpose of the liturgy. The purpose of the liturgy is the glorification of God and sanctification of the people.
Correct.
And the purpose of the church.
In that order, by the way.
That's right. That's right. And the purpose of the church is.
It mirrors it.
Yes. It's exactly that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even when there isn't a mass happening, it's still those. Does those two things.
Right.
It still offers offering mm-hmm. worship to God by its mere existence in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, a church is an offering mm-hmm. to God. And then two, sanctification of the people. When you walk mm-hmm. in, the church should draw you to heaven, right? Mm-hmm. It should make you want to be holy.
That's right.
By its That's images, right. by its beauty, by the reverence that it produces, mm-hmm. the sense of piety that it engenders. So,
I think you're looking for Sacrosanctum Concilium and or Spirit of Liturgy, wherein Benedict talks about that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure I've read it in multiple places. But yes, so those are the two first principles that you need to ask yourself. How well is your church doing those two things? Mm. If the answer is not that well, then that's where we begin.
Mm. Yeah, and I was thinking about something recently, and I overheard in a talk, or it was a discussion between, who was it? It was some people online. Jonathan Pageau was talking with a couple other mm-hmm. like thinkers, let's say public intellectuals. And he was talking about in worship, how you think about your spaces and how they affect you. Mm-hmm. And he had a line that stuck out to me where he said, you know, as a good starting point, your church should be nicer than your house. Like, yeah. you know, your worship spaces affect you. And it's like, he's trying to figure out how to put parameters on this without being mm-hmm. Too direct. But he's like, if your living room is nicer than your church,
yeah.
like if you spend more money, spend more time thinking about it, and that if your house is nicer than your church,
yeah.
pretty good starting point. Your priorities are, you know, they need to be sort of 180'd.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's actually really helpful. I intuitively thought that, but I never heard it said that way.
Yeah.
That's really helpful.
And it's very easy to kind of grok. Like you get in your head, you know what your house is like, and yeah. you know what your church is like.
Right.
And you probably think a lot about, at least we do. I mean, architects as a rule are probably just, there's a kind of subroutine going in the back of our minds. The conversation about like that wall could move and that door needs to be there eventually, but I don't want to do it now. And
yeah.
you're always kind of retooling your house. There should be a similar sort of thing. There should be a kind of deeper longing for your church where, I mean, it should never be done basically.
Right. Well, and I think it speaks to the natural instinct that some things should be nicer than others, right? Mm-hmm. So in other mm-hmm. words, like
yeah.
your department store should not be as nice as your church.
Right.
Right. Like that there is a hierarchy in society, you know, like there's the kind of lowly buildings at the bottom mm-hmm. and maybe civic public buildings. And then mm-hmm. at the very top should be the worship buildings.
That's right.
I think modernism eroded all of that, mm-hmm. but I don't think that the instinct for that ever went away.
No,
people still have that instinct.
Yeah, you can't.
You know, so So that's really interesting. But so then the other thing you need to think about as you're preparing to renovate your church is, okay, so we talked about the two purposes of a church, but ultimately the purpose of a church is to have mass, right? Like that is the reason for being, right, of a church is right. To have mass. Okay, so then what is mass? Mass is the offering of the Son to the Father for the forgiveness of sins. I mean, it is the ultimate sacrifice of the Son as he offers himself to the Father to accomplish our salvation so that we might live, honestly, so that we might be God, right? That's right. Ultimately the end of everything. So then the building should reflect the fact that you're there for the saving action of Christ. Mass right. is a participation in the saving action of Christ. And yep. everything about it should emphasize that. Everything about it should point to that. So if your church doesn't have that kind of hierarchy, doesn't have that kind of directionality, you need to renovate it. Mm-hmm. Something's wrong. If you walk in, you don't know where the altar is, you don't know where the tabernacle is, the baptismal font seems to be more important than the altar, mm-hmm. or the niche to Our Lady of Guadalupe, no offense to Our Lady, is way more prominent than the altar, something's backwards.
Right.
You know, you have to address that. So those are the kind of things that would necessitate or demand mm-hmm. a renovation in your church.
Yeah.
As a starting point.
Yeah, something that is not properly explaining like the reality of life. Like if the hierarchy that you know to be true is being misrepresented by the sort of material facts of the space, mm-hmm. where the lighting is, you know, designed and the way you're giving, you know, sort of spatial or material hierarchy yeah. preference, you need to kind of reorder that so that it's saying what something's true.
Yes, yes. And it's, I mean, I think you and I have talked a lot about this. The problem that so many churches have where you have to do the mental gymnastics of, I know what is true, but the building is telling me something else. Mm. And so you have to, in your head, hold the truth as you're sitting there watching the host being elevated and knowing that nothing around you, nothing in the built space around you is reinforcing what you're seeing.
Yeah.
And how difficult that is, especially to sustain that over decades. Maybe you can do it if you're visiting a parish here or there, but to sustain that over decades is very difficult. So there's an urgency. There is an urgency. You know, I started out by saying there's no emergency. Mm-hmm. There is a liturgical emergency if your church is actually fighting what is happening on the altar. And that there are some cases of churches where that is the case.
Yeah.
You know, where everything about the building is diminishing the importance of the altar. Mm-hmm. And yet that is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's like it weighs on you.
Yeah.
It's something you have to overcome every time you go to mass, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's where you begin. You begin by, now let's, you know, we've gone from the broad and now let's get more specific.
So let's, before we leave the broad, let's make the broad a concrete.
Yeah.
What that means, which you've basically said over the last 10 minutes, is that you have to basically know what's up with the liturgy and you have to know what it is that you're doing. And that means that I'll go ahead and say someone besides the priest, because the priest is probably not the only person making decisions.
Yeah.
You need your primary decision makers, your points of contact, to be people you can trust implicitly with what you have just described as right. being, you need to know why you're doing what you're doing. The people that make the decisions need to be able to do that or to know that the decisions they're making, they need to defer to people who know what they're doing.
Right.
So it's essentially sort of placing the authority in the right hands is yes. what I'm saying. And yes. to know those hands are there instead of, because there's probably a pastor listening to this. Maybe we have a pastor listening to this who's like, yeah, I got it. But then the first mistake and the worst mistake is he's like, and my guy who handles maintenance for the chapel will just, it's like,
right.
That's not the way to do it. You have to make sure the right people are in the right place.
Yes.
So establishing your team that is on board
and yes.
knows how the party works.
Exactly.
It's important.
No. And having, having some humility about your own limitations, both in terms of knowledge, but if you're a pastor, in terms of time, you may not have time to address all these things.
That's right.
Projects are complicated, they take a long time. Mm-hmm. So you need to be able to delegate properly to people you trust. And so, yeah, that's a very good point. Mm-hmm. The other thing is you really do need to lean on tradition for this. I mean, the only way to safeguard your design against whim and innovation, you know, people just being like, hey, how about we put the tabernacle in the closet, you know? Well, there's a reason why you wouldn't do that. Or let's put, instead of putting the altar in the middle, let's put the baptismal font in the middle. Well, you can't do that. There's a reason you wouldn't do that. You know, so making sure you have the resources to know what liturgically makes sense, again, to align with the Mass, the saving action of Christ that we get to participate every time we're there, is super important. And so without that knowledge and that base, then we're just flying blind, kind of like what we're doing this episode.
Flying blind.
Flying blind because we don't have any headphones.
Yeah, so I'm assuming the audio levels are correct. So we've talked about, we haven't talked about how to spend money. This episode is how to spend your $1 million. So correct. How do you guide someone? Someone calls you and literally says, we want to kind of spend $1 million, but no more.
Yeah.
What are the parameters?
Okay, so now we've established why you would do something and what is important, what is not important.
Yeah.
I think you would need to first identify, what is working really well in my church right now? So is there a certain liturgical element or certain aspect of the architecture or the space that you could say like, wow, this works really well. This is really beautiful, or this is really captivating, or this is, you know, this has been here a long time and the parishioners, you know, really like it, but caveat to that, but it is not contrary to the liturgy.
Right.
Because sometimes people are really attached to something that's horrific. I'm just saying, if there's something really beautiful that is already supporting the mission of your church and supporting the liturgy and the celebration of the liturgy, then start there. Identify those elements. Yeah. Hopefully there's multiple. There might just be one.
Yeah. Listeners should basically presume that when you say something like that, implicit in those statements are that it's orthodox and it's not crazy and like, you know.
That's right. So identify those elements that you're going to use as the cornerstones of this new design, of this renovation that you're doing. From there, you look at the hierarchy of importance of liturgical elements. Of course, the most important thing in a church is, Chris?
The guitar. The drums. No, it's the altar. It's the place of, actually it's Jesus, but the altar being the symbol of him and the place where the sacrifice takes place.
And I heard some other book. I need to remember what books I read these days. But we basically said, you can't overstate the importance of the altar. You're really building a church around an altar.
Right.
Not the other way around.
Right. And what are you building? We're building an altar.
We're building an altar.
It happens to come with the skin.
Yeah, we need a shelter. Yeah. So yes, so the altar as the most prominent thing. So that would be the first place to go. From there, the ambo would come next. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, this was kind of surprising to me.
Yeah, go into this.
The presider's chair would come after that. Now, I will say the tabernacle, you know, is almost an extension of the altar. And for a long time, tabernacles were on the altar, right? I mean, that basically since the Council of Trent, that was the case.
That was it.
For hundreds of years. So I'm actually counting the tabernacle as part of the altar extension, you know, kind of idea.
Yeah.
So altar, tabernacle, ambo, and then presider's chair.
Why is that? Can you go through why the hierarchy is altar, ambo, presider's chair?
Yeah, because in a way they each represent a different aspect of Christ, right? So Christ's sacrifice on the altar, the ambo as the proclamation of the gospel, you know, the word made flesh, and then the presider's chair as the priest who is in persona Christi, right? So he's there representing Christ. Mm-hmm. And so his person is part of that liturgy and is part of our understanding of Christ, you know, in the liturgy. So those three together form a certain, they should have a certain visual unity. Mm-hmm. So if you have these three elements and they don't look anything like each other, or worse, they clash, that's something that needs to be addressed. There should be a unity between those three elements.
And there should be no indistinction between the two. If there's an altar in the church, you know which one's the altar, right? If meaning there shouldn't be more than one. If there's an ambo, the ambo should be, if you have a lectern, the ambo should be of a higher order, of a higher dignity,
right?
There should be only one. If you have a presider's chair and you have chairs for deacons and servers and things, implicit in what you said is that the presider's chair should be notably different from the rest of them.
That's a very good point. Yes.
So these things, I mean, it would be like having an altar here and an altar there, and then there being two Christs and I mean, it's striking to me that I think there are a lot of places where the presider's chair is only marginally different. Maybe the back is a little taller or something, but it is part of the liturgical furnishing trinity of mm-hmm. things that then has a fourth or fifth wheel up in sanctuary.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, that it's almost like that chair is representing, you know, to bring in our conversation the other day about the queen, the dignity of the office priest is represented by the presider's chair. And if that is not in any way distinguished, you lose some of the importance of that symbolism.
Mm. Yeah. Because in a way it's like Christ's Eucharistic presence, his presence in the word, and his presence being the one high priest. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's all about Jesus.
It's all about Jesus.
Right. So the priest, the presider's chair is for the presider, who is Christ.
Right.
Like your pastor's there, but he is there in the person of Jesus.
Yeah. Like the priest could be any priest.
Yeah.
It's because he is, in a way, he is diminishing. Mm-hmm. He's diminishing himself to be Christ for us.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the significance. It's not because he's the king or something.
Right. He subsumes himself into the role of priest.
That's it.
Almost where who he is doesn't matter insofar as they're an individual who is, you know, leading the mass. It's actually Jesus. So, you talked about what's working well. What are the design cornerstones? What are you kind of anchoring things on?
Right.
Just because it makes sense to maintain something, just, you know, you have a financial reason and you have a kind of design reason and you have a tradition of your space.
Right.
So you have a design anchor, and then you talked about the most important things on top of those design anchors, which actually made these three liturgical furnishings, altar, ambo, and presider's chair, are prior in importance to what works well. Maybe they're not necessarily in conflict with one another. But what's next after that?
After that, you zoom out to the sanctuary as a whole, right? So you can almost think of it as the sanctuary being, it's like, it's an amplification of what's up there. So it's an echo of the liturgical elements. Mm-hmm. And so visually, the sanctuary should elevate the dignity of the altar, of the ambo, of the presider's chair, right? So for example, you could have the nicest altar ever, but then the sanctuary is like sheet vinyl tile and plywood. Well, that's not going to work, right?
Yeah,
that would just like totally crash the whole party. So it needs to be an amplification, a beautification. It needs to reveal even more of the dignity of those elements than those elements themselves, right? And so put your money in the sanctuary. Put your money on the reredos or the back wall. You know, a lot of times that's where the tabernacle is now. So the tabernacle, because it's our Lord, right? Is where we reserve the Eucharist. It needs to also have proper dignity and beauty. And again, if you think about, you know, if we think about the Mass as a beautiful choreography, right? There's movements. There's like movements that happen. The servers come in and out. The priest moves in and out. You know, if there is ad orientum, he turns around at certain points. Like there's a choreography to it. Well, in a certain sense, the reredos, the back wall of the church, the sanctuary, is the backdrop for, I mean, you're watching salvation history unfold before your eyes.
Yeah.
And so that needs to, again, reveal some of that to you in plain terms. Instead of us having to do mental gymnastics because we're staring at a blank wall, the art should highlight and reveal the saving action that we're watching before our eyes.
Yeah. You know?
And so that's where your money should go. Mm.
And there's something of the procession from the narthex, like the antechamber, into the nave. Narthex outside of where you sit, the nave being the hull of the ship where most people will sit. Yeah. And then further down the line, the sanctuary. There's something about moving into the temple, into a kind of deeper veiled place where in the sanctuary, in the Holy of Holies, that's where there's, in some way, you can see the least, but the most is revealed because you're not seeing with human eyes, but you're seeing the thing that's more real beyond the physical. So it should speak to what you were saying is you're entering into that sort of layered experience. The sanctuary should be different from the places that are prior to it.
Right.
The first place being out in the world, mm-hmm. and then you enter.
Yeah.
Just speaking to the sort of nature of liturgy being absolutely. Processional.
No, that's a great point. And I think you would spend money proportional to that relationship. So moving from the narthex to the sanctuary, the level of ornamentation should be increasing noticeably.
Yeah.
And then the great crescendo of the church is the sanctuary. And it visibly should be that, you know? So again, if you get to the sanctuary and it's kind of a letdown, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything needs to build up. It's almost like you're climbing a mountain, right?
That's right.
Mount Tabor, here we come. And you finally get to the top, right? So the architecture, the ornamentation of a church should do something very similar from narthex to sanctuary. And you should notice that. That should be visible, you know?
Yeah. I had a thought that I would not recommend doing in the liturgy, but the type of thing made me think about how when you're you know those like gender reveal parties where you pop a thing and like the little confetti things? It's like you should walk in, the first place should be fine, the second place in procession should be like a little better, but as you get to the sanctuary, it should be the architectural and ornamental equivalent of just like a dozen people on either side popping like, these things, and you're just like, boom! Like it should be this... It should be noticeably different and like joyful and glorifying God in a way that like don't pop those in mass, but you should have the same kind of like, you know, eye-opening experience.
Well, I mean, think about the Eastern Church, right? Where do they have the iconostasis? I mean, and how ornate that is, how overwhelmingly visual that
is. Right, right, yeah.
I mean, there is no question what's the most important part of an Orthodox church, right? Or a Catholic Eastern Rite church. So
that's right.
There's something to be learned there.
Fireworks at that point, yeah.
You know, there's something to be learned that your eye should... you should almost be pulled towards the front, towards the sanctuary by the beauty and by everything else.
That's right.
So, but, you know, you made a good point about procession. So let's say you've spent your money, you've renovated the sanctuary, and that is properly distinguished and beautiful and dignified. So as you're moving your way back, now you're in the nave. How do you spend money there? And I love what you said, and I know that you did this at St. Thomas More, your parish, of highlighting the center aisle, highlighting that procession from narthex to church. So maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the liturgy begins, I mean, there's probably some actual place where it begins, but I'll just say it probably begins in the priest's sacristy when they're vesting, and before Mass ever starts, the priest will pray. Each of the vestments has a kind of psalm where you will pray. And in the Orthodox Church, it's like even more elaborate than we have in the Latin Rite or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And the priest will begin prior to even entering the narthex by praying these prayers and putting on his, you know, various elements that he'll wear. And then for certain liturgies, it'll begin outside when you're lighting the fire or the Easter candle or whatever you're doing. And then you'll process into the church if you're not already in the narthex. And then you'll move your way through a song or the sort of entrance antiphon down the center aisle, working your way up to the front. And there's a point where you're beginning in the narthex and you're kind of, you know, walking the congregation through a growing intimacy with Christ, where in the beginning you're outside of the church, meaning you're outside of relationship with him.
Yeah.
And then in, you know, sort of traditional churches, the baptismal font was in the back, either in the narthex or towards the back of the nave or even outside. The baptistry in Florence is a separate building.
Yeah.
Because that is outside of what happens inside the space.
Right.
So spatially symbolizing that baptism is the means by which you enter into sort of indelible relationship with Christ. Mm-hmm. And then as you move closer to the altar of sacrifice, you move closer to the point where you can receive him Eucharistically. Mm-hmm. And that movement towards Christ is a thing that has a kind of sanctifying path.
Yeah.
So that center aisle, which hopefully you have one, we believe it or not, didn't have a center aisle for a long
time. That's a good point. Yeah. That's true.
That's an important thing, to have and to highlight. And you know, in the end of Mass, people will, you know, in some ways gather in the middle and go down that aisle too. So it's really a kind of path of journey towards him, into receiving him. So,
yeah, I mean, it's a mirror of our pilgrimage, right, to the heavenly Jerusalem. Like you're actually walking the steps that you take, and you're reminded constantly that you came through the waters of baptism.
That's right.
You're going through your life, and your goal, your end, is heaven, which is a sanctuary,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So another thing that I think echoes this really well, and I think we need to go back to, which is a funny thing to say, you'll see here in a moment. So narthexes used to be tiny, cramped, and dark spaces.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And now there's a trend to kind of have these giant narthexes that are like lobbies. And
yeah.
But like, go to a old cathedral, you know, go to an old Gothic cathedral especially, and you enter the narthex and it's dark and small and you feel constricted.
Yeah.
Well, that's because it's symbolic of the darkness of sin before you've been baptized, right? So you are in this, you're almost in the cave, right? In Plato's cave. Mm-hmm. And then you open the doors, and in a Gothic church, it's flooded with light.
Yeah.
Well, now you see the fact that through baptism, you enter the society of the church. You are now a son of God, and you're filled with light, you know, the light of Christ. We've kind of lost that symbolism. Now you enter the lobby, narthex, and it's this giant cavernous space, and a lot of times it's quite nice. And then the church door is just an afterthought. You just kind of go in. Yeah. It's like, okay, it's part of the same deal. Mm. So we've kind of lost the symbolism of the narthex. It'd be nice to recapture some of that.
It's almost like, and I hadn't really thought about this until you just elaborated your narthex thought. It's like, and I have thought this too, so I'm guilty as well as everyone else who I'm going to accuse in this comment, is that you think about the narthex almost first in terms of the quality of space you want to linger in after Mass.
Right.
Not the kind of space where the priest and the servers and all of those, you know, participating in Mass will begin the liturgy.
Right.
Like, is it the best place to, is it the fitting place to begin the liturgy? Most of the time it's like, well, is that big enough for people to hang out after Mass?
Right.
And it's not that you don't want to think about that, but that should not be the first thing you're thinking about.
Yeah.
It should be secondary to its fittingness for the liturgy.
I would actually advocate that we need a separate space for gathering after Mass. You know what I mean? So you still need the narthex. Mm-hmm. So then the space to gather after Mass, which is important, socializing, et cetera, just needs to be a separate thing.
Yeah, and in Houston, that's a big deal.
It's a big deal.
Stinking hot.
No, I mean, I would not advocate for getting rid of it, but just bringing back the narthex.
Yeah, and if you shrink it, then it's very clear that its purpose is not for...
For gathering.
Lingering.
It's a place of preparation.
Yeah, it's a place of preparation.
And transition, so... Yeah, no, that's a great point. So again, we're working our way back towards the narthex. Mm-hmm. That's where you would spend your money if you don't have a proper narthex. Make it dark.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't run any air conditioning to it. You know, make it miserable.
Make it really awful.
But center aisle. Beyond that, you know, why, you know, churches a lot of times have shrines and statues and artwork. Mm-hmm. Well, why is it important to have art in the nave of a church? Mm-hmm. What would you say to that? Or statues in the nave of a church?
Yeah. I think, you know, having kids that are young, it's really nice when kids walk into a building and they get it, and the art, and as well as the architecture, but the sign and symbol, the narrative of the life of faith is on display. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons is just that's how kids absorb things in Mass. They're not going to be listening and sort of absorbing the dialectic from the homily and splicing the old reading, Old Testament and the Psalms together. They're going to look at that thing and be like, why is that guy poking Jesus in the side?
Yeah.
And be like, ow. Like, so they're going to be meditating on the visual part of the church.
Yep.
And if you opt for an approach to art and architecture that is very minimal and very sophisticated, let's say, I'm using scare quotes, sophisticated, then what you're doing is you're saying that the only way the kids are going to be able to absorb the story of the faith is through the intellect,
right?
Which means they're not going to get it until they're very old.
Yeah.
But if you imbue sign and symbol and your stations of the cross are not just crosses,
right?
But I mean, like, they're not just a cross, but they're actually a depiction of the story.
Right.
And you have artwork that's real and your stained glass is legible and it's not super abstract. You're allowing kids from the time they're young, 2 and 3, to look up and to see a picture and to start forming the story in their mind. So what you're doing is in some way an act of charity to the kids who can't read and can't think.
Can't
read good. The kids can't read good and can't follow along with their awesome homilies that all the priests always give. You're just allowing it to be for them. And now that's also true for adults. It's nice to look at these things and meditate on them. But... And it's nice too, like if I think about your center aisle, when you can look down and say, you know, not everyone's going to catechize their kid as someone who's, as a hobby, just reads theology books and books about faith.
Yeah.
But if someone who's like kind of into their faith, but hasn't really read a lot and is kind of trying to get into it, if the building can help you, that's a huge advantage for the parent to be like, to be kind of interested in art and the stories of the faith and kind of know a little bit about Mass, but to just point and be like, see that? That's where Jesus had to carry his cross, and that's where Mary was there. And
yeah.
it allows you to not have to just rely on what you've memorized.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I specifically am thinking as I'm talking about this of the churches I've been to where there are nice stations. And after the fact, the kids will bring up on their own something they saw that was not part of Mass, but they've just been looking to the left for 45 minutes at it.
Yeah.
So
it makes me think of St. Joseph Catholic Church downtown. I went to Mass there with my daughters one time, and they were praying the rosary for Mass. Mm. And the stained glass windows in the church are the mysteries of the rosary.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was funny because they would announce the next mystery, and I would bump my daughter and be like, look, that's right there. Hey, but that's cool. You know, it's almost like you are praying the rosary, but it's like it's alive because the windows are right there, you know, and you can follow along. So that's really, really cool. Yeah, so there's a catechetical component to it, you know, that the church should teach, and it does teach. And then, of course, there's the eschatological component, to use a big scary word for some, but you know, that the Mass is not something that takes place just in the here and now, but when we go to Mass, we're worshiping God with all the angels and saints, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the beautiful thing about Mass. It's the time where we get to time travel every time we go.
That's right.
You know, the whole universe is collapsed into a single moment, you know, into the eternal now, which is amazing. But the artwork should reflect the fact that the angels and saints are right there with us.
Yeah.
So all of that, the artwork that you choose, the way that you embellish and decorate, the way that you use ornamentation in the nave should remind us that we are participating in the eternal now of the liturgy, right? And so, yes, salvation history can be part of that and it can teach us, but it needs to remind us that we're there in the cloud of witnesses every Sunday or every time we go to Mass. And so as you renovate your nave, that's what you need to have in mind, or at least part of what you need to have in mind is that.
Yeah.
All right. So we've already spent about $3 million. So now let's work our way back to the narthex. We talked about the narthex a little bit.
Yeah.
So let's finally talk about the front of your church.
The front, the portal, like the outside?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what if the front of your church doesn't look like a church?
Yeah, it's tough. We're not going to not talk about practical things too. I know we've talked about a kind of hierarchy we've established, but the outside is tough because when you start touching the outside of your building, you probably have a campus. It's probably not a single building. And then there are issues about how the campus reads as a whole. And when you start touching the exterior of a building, there are a lot of technical questions that come up. So from a practical perspective, if you're going to do work, an interior renovation,
that's a great point,
is something that's going to be a much bigger bang for your buck.
Yeah.
So if you want to touch the outside of your building, it is a different project. It is of a different category.
Okay. So then let me put, that's a really great point.
Yeah. I'd even say if the title of this episode, which we're sticking to, I like it, is it's provocative, is we want to spend no more than $1 million.
Yeah.
I would say you cannot do interior and exterior for under $1 million.
Yeah.
Choose one or the other.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. What if it's just landscaping?
You could do that.
We did that at St. Thomas More. By the way, and next time you see Father Clark, tell him the landscaping outside of St. Thomas More is
awesome.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It's
delightful. Yeah. Every time I go to that church, because I'm going to be honest, I don't think the front of that church is very nice.
No,
it doesn't say church at all.
Yeah.
But when I walk up there, it's beautiful. Like,
it's very nice. Yeah.
All the color, it looks lush, it looks vibrant. I'm like, this is great.
You know? There is one of the four planters that is not symmetrical, and it may work for like circulation purposes, but I still want to move it over to the side and put a fountain or a place to have the Easter Vigil fire and everything there, have a proper liturgical place. Yeah. But yes, you're right. The planting. So, I mean, we did that basically, had just nice, flowers and bushes. I think there were some crepe myrtle trees or whatever out in front that are nice.
It's beautiful. Like, I don't know. I mean, it really does a lot.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to do anything to the building.
Yeah,
you
know,
it's all landscape. But no, but I like your distinction. I think that if you want to do anything for $1 million, it's going to be all interior work.
Yeah. And we should maybe have another episode about exterior, but the provocation here, and I'm gonna bring it back down. We have an episode titled What Can You Do for $1 million?
Yeah.
Max.
Right.
No more. I'm going to lay down a few sort of practical things. The church wants to spend no more than $1 million. That right. probably means you need to have a 10% contingency. So yeah. we're just going to get real nuts and bolts. You have a $900,000 budget is what you actually have.
Right.
And if that's a total project budget and you hire an architect or a liturgical designer or someone to do that, part of that money goes to paying that professional for their time.
Right.
And depending on the work that's done, I'm assuming it's not going to be structural and it's not going to require consultants right. like mechanical, electrical, yeah. plumbing, maybe lighting. So that would be an additional right. one. So if you have a $900,000,
that's a great point.
Lighting would be one you'd want to.
Such a huge difference.
And then you have to maybe get into hiring an electrical engineer, depending on how much has to be reworked, maybe even an AV consultant. Mm-hmm. So there are electrical AV, MEP or MEP is electrical, lighting, AV, electrical, and architectural.
Right.
There you're already hiring, and this is, I'm trying to just make it real practical. You're hiring four professional consultants who right. all have, who as a business model, they sell time as a professional service.
Yep.
Right. Now there are deliverables they give, but your $1 million max budget became 900 as a just a conservative contingency.
Right.
And then, you're going to have some big chunk, you know, maybe not $100,000, but you know, let's just say 50 or 60 is going to be professional fees. Totally. Yeah. Like that's what you're going to pay someone to begin doing the work or to do the work. Then your $1 million project became 850. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's a total project budget and you haven't paid your contractor yet to do the work.
Yep.
So the cost of work may be something more like, I don't know, $700,000. So this is just a kind of real world gut check for people who say, you know, someone came and gave us $1 million check. What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. You do not have $1 million to spend on painting.
That's right.
Lots of things go to professionals and things like that. So, yeah. So how do you just like quite literally thinking about dollar bills? How do you start giving practical? We have established the hierarchy of goods, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
That is absolutely important. Where's big bang for your buck?
I mean, I would say the big bang for the buck is always going to be the sanctuary. That's what everybody sees. That's what everyone's excited about. That's the easiest to fundraise for. Mm-hmm. Let's put it in buckets. I mean, what could you do for $1 million? If, for example, you did not have, if your altar, ambo, and presider's chair were all terrible, mm-hmm. and you wanted to renovate the back wall of your church to be more beautiful.
Yeah.
That could be $1 million right there. Just that. Mm. Right.
Just all painting.
In. Yeah. Just new altar, which would
I see. Yeah.
You know, new altar, new, like basically replacing your liturgical furniture and then doing something nice on the back wall. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even talking like super fancy millwork or anything, but just like some nice color, maybe a few material changes, mm-hmm. Maybe a crucifix, mm-hmm. but that's about it. That's how far you could get. That means you're sticking with the flooring you have. If most of your liturgical furniture were okay, mm-hmm. you could redo the flooring, maybe in your whole church. You could potentially upgrade your back wall behind your altar. Mm-hmm. And then maybe have a little bit of money left for some lighting upgrades for your sanctuary.
So you're saying a 60s church where you just sort of, you know, the parish is down the party, they want to fundraise for it, and they say, we're going to set $1 million goal, a reasonable scope for that work. Now this is like, you know, mid, early Q3 2022.
Yeah.
the only reason I bring that up is we've seen projects in our office professionally so that listeners are aware where we're at in the grand arc of things and they listen to this 10 years from now. We've seen projects over the last 12 months increase in cost just by virtue of time.
Yeah.
140%.
Yep.
Meaning 40% increase. So the cost 100% a year and a half ago is now 140% of that cost.
Yeah.
40% more. So you're saying that a reasonable $1 million scope would be new altar, nice altar, mm-hmm. like made of marble and beautiful, ambo altar, presider's chair, sanctuary rework. Maybe there's wood paneling. Mm-hmm. Maybe the lighting has been updated so that all these things are kind of given their right order. $1 million, mm-hmm. sanctuary reno.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be a noticeably different facelift. So you would, I mean, it would be a pretty good good size renovation, but yes, that you would want to spend, especially again, you want some nice sacred art up there. You want it to be nice. So yes, I would budget something like that. If you want to do a more general renovation that included new flooring in your whole church, let's say, then I think you would not have enough money to do some of the other upgrades.
And a lot of these things too are system wide, and it doesn't make sense to do.
And of course, the other caveat is depending on the size of your church, right? I mean,
yeah, we're just
thinking of middle of the road, like St. Thomas More's type parish,
right?
You know,
yeah,
seats, 800,
yeah,
something like that,
yeah. And a lot of these things too, when you think about how to budget, we've talked about let's say principles the first half of the episode. This back half, we're just trying to really plant some flags in the ground. Yeah. I'm assuming that if you're listening to this so far right now, you're not just marginally interested and you're actually trying to figure out how to move on this project. So I'm helping you, dear listener, plant some flags. A lot of the things you should consider too are system-wide updates. So you don't partially update an AV system.
Right.
You, from the AV IT room and electrical panel, do a new system. Mm-hmm. So these things are kind of buckets where maybe if you have a once a year you want to do a project upgrade, maybe it's you spend $100,000 or $200,000 doing a really nice AV upgrade system wide,
right?
Or lighting, same way. If you're going to touch lighting, then maybe you go ahead and do all of it, because the costs of mobilizing some of these trades and consultants is built in. So if you do part of it, and then next year you do part of it, next year you do part of it, you're paying for them to go out to the site. And when I say mobilize, I mean they're not just driving to the site, but they're moving all of their equipment into the space. So that the next day they just go home and come back and their equipment is still in the space. So the mobilization costs amortized over long periods of time will add up. So you want to get them in to do a particular system at a time. So it really makes sense to maybe phase by system and not by space. Yeah. So if you do the sanctuary and you do lighting, maybe you do sanctuary and the lighting for the rest of the building.
Yeah.
And if you do AV, maybe you do AV all at once. Art can also be phased. Mm-hmm. It's, you have to think about what you're doing and you have to be patient. I know you've talked about this, I think at length on a few episodes, but willingness to be patient and do it right is important. Like the sort of Steve Jobs maxim where he harps on the mill worker who will finish the back of the drawer because it's the right thing to do. And because the ethic is what matters, inside of the iPhone, things are organized beautifully. If the device with the symbol of the fall of mankind on it is more well ordered than the space where we worship God and give him glory, then there's that's anecdote to kind of exaggerate to make a point, but it's important, I think, to be willing to wait a little while and buy the right statue or the right Stations of the Cross or do that and imagine that it's not going to change.
Well, and to just increase the quality. I mean, how many churches have we been into that have like the plastic figurines from China? Mm. And, just because they thought, well, it's better to have something. And I'm not sure that's necessarily the case. I think it's better to have less statues, but that are of higher quality. Because remember, like it's not just, we need a statue of Jesus. Who cares what it looks like? I mean, you're trying to engender devotion, piety, and you're not going to do that with a plastic statue from China. I'm sorry. And so, take your time, be patient, you're going to spend more money, but.
And be willing to take what you already have. This is a kind of note of encouragement for those who have pastoral concerns. If you have something that's not good in your building, do your pastoral due diligence, but be bold and don't be afraid to throw out a statue that's terrible. And
it's hard. I mean, get a good one. And we recognize the difficulty of something like that and the pitfalls of it all. But I mean, ultimately, there's just nothing worse than walking into a church with a bunch of statues that look like they're sugar coated.
Yeah.
Like candy statues.
Oh my gosh. And they become the stuff of
memes.
It's
the opposite of what a statue should do, So, okay. So then just to wrap up, because we're out of time, dear listener. I mean, this is going to sound self-serving, but get yourself a professional who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because that's, in order to renovate a church well, you're going to have to run through many scenarios. You're going to have to study many different options, how to do it well. And you're going to want to see what all of that costs. And the only way you're going to be able to do that is if you have a competent professional that can help you and walk you through all of that. Yeah. So give us a call. No.
Advertisement.
So, well, whether it's us or somebody else, just find an architect who really knows the liturgy, loves the church, and who has an understanding of these things to help you walk through and
actually, I should
and
say,
get to this vision.
To add the real last thing, it is, there's always a question in my mind of how to start. Like, people don't quite know how to get started. And I think the right order of operations is to cast a vision and then produce some sort of imagery. Like, the first step is not getting to the end. The first step is sort of figuring out what's going to be there.
Yeah.
And then producing something to fundraise with. Mm-hmm. And then that first step is not going to cost you your $1 million.
Right.
You're going to spend, like, you know, 2% of the budget just producing, like, say you want to buy Stations of the Cross, and it's going to cost you $40,000 to get a beautiful set of stations. You're going to spend a little bit of money, or, you know, just producing, let's say, like, full-scale charcoal renderings, put them up on an easel, show people after Mass, do that sort of thing and get buy-in, because people will want to participate. Like, it's an act of charity to allow someone to spend their money in a way that glorifies God. Right. If you just sort of go buy it yourself, then in a way you're not allowing people to contribute to the glorification of God and the sanctification of the people by virtue of giving you the hard-earned money. So the first step is to allow people to participate by virtue of giving their money. So I just had to slip that there.
Amen.
Amen. All right. I think that's a wrap.
Tell your friends. Share and like. Subscribe.
What are all the things that we have to say at this point? Cool.